Welcome back to the Strutcom podcast. Today, we're joined by the big boss, the director of the NATO Strutcom COE, Jani Sartz. Jani, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
I don't know if you remember, the last time we spoke, we were about 2 months into Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. We were talking about episodes such as the heroic defense of Snake Island. We were talking about the role of pre-bunking in the lead-up to the invasion. Oh, how the times are different, and yet there is no clear end in sight when it comes to this war. Maybe you could outline what can we expect in the coming months.
Now, as we speak in April, everybody is very much focused on the Ukrainian counteroffensive, and I think quite a lot rests on that counteroffensive. First and foremost, this will be the counteroffensive when the West has delivered quite a lot of the Western equipment. That would be, in a way, one would argue, the first kind of very much dependent on the Western equipment offensive that Ukraine will do, first. Second, I think also the kind of overall context has changed. It's been more than a year. Russia is weakened. So I think a successful offensive could further weaken the Russia's options and could facilitate further processes within Russia on the one side. On the other side, if it is failing, then the risk is it will kind of strengthen the groups within Russia that are looking for the very extended conflict. And of course, what I think very important is the Western resolve. And although I think right now it stands strong, yet we cannot count it for granted. And clearly, I think if that counteroffensive is not successful, there'll be clearly emergence of the voices in the West that would say, well, let's seek compromise, let's make Ukraine kind of give up things. The trouble with that approach is I think it is risky. Because obviously, whoever listens to what is the rhetorics of Russia, it's not the war on Ukraine, it's the war on the West. And as such, I think it will be seen, whatever the compromise is being achieved, as a pause rather than the end. And that has to be clearly understood by everyone.
So this is actually exactly what I wanted to follow up on. The kind of modification in Russia's approach and in the narratives it employs. So despite suffering enormous loss of equipment and, according to some estimates, even up to 200,000 casualties in battlefield, Putin has clearly signaled a willingness to continue to play this long game. This involves, militarization of society, preparation of a wartime economy geared for the long-term confrontation. And we see these narratives changing from a special military operation to now it's a war. A campaign against just a fascist Kyiv regime is now a confrontation against all of NATO. How has NATO responded to this escalation of narrative?
I think there has been also a strengthening of the will on NATO's part to support Ukraine. There's been a shift. What is the desirable outcome, which is not was shifted from Ukraine is not to lose to Ukraine has to win, which is, I think, a very significant shift. In practical terms, the kind of equipment we've seen delivered and will be employed during the counteroffensive is like sea change from what was a debate about a year ago. So I think there's been a strengthening of the resolve on the part of the West. But of course, we have to recognize it's a constant work. It's a constant effort to have that unity. And also, in a way, ironically, Russia has helped to create that resolve by the way they act.
The
horrific behavior, just like right out of the Middle Ages. is something that, of course, stiffens that resolve. And I find it's rather paradoxical how Russia is unable to factor that in. And I think it's not like they couldn't understand the ramifications, but I don't think they are able to control that. Even understanding that might not work in their own favor.
I want to follow up with a question on the methods used and also the implications for the reputation of Russia, or rather of the Putin regime. One of the core principles that the Ukrainian representatives have publicly promoted has been that they will not hold negotiations with Putin personally. And just recently we saw ICC issue an arrest warrant for Putin, stamping him with this very toxic pariah status. Do you think this puts an end to the hopes of those politicians, either in the West or elsewhere, who still held out hope that you can talk with Putin? Do you think it's possible to hold negotiations with an accused war criminal?
Like, from the values set of things, of course not. From realpolitik, you can imagine that people would try to. Yet, I think there's another angle there, and that is also in a way what has led to the choices Putin has made, is that he has not much options for choice. I think his behavior, always upping the ante, always trying to escalate instead of kind of step back, is the recognition of his own personal welfare and well-being being linked to the outcome of this war directly. And in that sense, I think even this idea that there is a real politique option for discussion doesn't hold the ground. Because unless he wins, it's seen not only by the many around the globe as weakness, but primarily also for those within Russia as weakness. And that is the last thing he can afford, being seen as weak within Russia.
But recognizing the stakes, I mean, existential stakes for Putin himself personally, doesn't this play into the slippery slope narrative of, well, then Putin can't lose? Because he simply can't afford to lose. So does that mean that we should expect kind of raising the bar of escalation moving forward?
Even probably in our previous episode, which was a year ago, I think that was the conventional wisdom that Putin is going to escalate. He's not going to back down. And it has, as we see years since, has holden true. Yet it has for him the very clear calculus, the reason of escalation, to preserve his own personal security. So from that perspective, some steps of escalation just don't like sound very rational. And of course, also the system around him is something one has to take into account. I think very interesting was this leaked discussion between two Russian tycoons, if I may call them this way, and the kind of sentiment that came out of that discussion between the kind of producer of the shows and the billionaire, small oligarch, let's put it this way. And I think
small that, by Russian standards.
Yeah, obviously. So I think that is also something that he is taking into consideration and has to. And as we speak, I think there's kind of two further more trends happening. Is it appears that finally economy is catching up on Russia. One, and second, they're in desperate need for another set of mobilization. Yet these two factors together with a sentiment behind that, at least the way they're trying to kind of juggle with that, is I interpret they understand the risks for the kind of vertical itself. But one has to give this one kind of, it's not a credit, you shouldn't call it credit. It's like one has to recognize he's been able to control the situation within Russia beyond what I would have expected. So the skills are there, the capability is there, but at some point there's going to be a breaking point. I don't have doubt on that.
But yet there is still buy-in at least, maybe not actively, but at least passively from the majority of Russian society, which means that the regime will be able to implement further mobilization, further rounds. So there is still room to maneuver, it seems.
It's an interesting question. First, yes, they were able to pull out the first wave of mobilization. I think to their own surprise, there was very little pushback. But one has to recognize that was against the wave of people that fled Russia to avoid mobilization. They've been extremely hesitant to go for the second wave, although I would argue from a military logic that should have happened way ago, but it has not yet. There's a deliberation about how those that are being given summons are going to get them digitally, what would be the repercussions if they don't, you know, show up, and etc., etc. Very, very drastic measures that I hear of. And there's been kind of sentiment within a ruling elite that is step too far. So you clearly see there's a need to do something very drastic to kind of uphold the military tempo on one side. On the other side, the awareness, what it can cause internally. So
it's not an easy spot.
No. Well, that's all their creation. And many people suffer for that. But I would argue, yes, they've done it quite considerably well with the first wave. But I think any extra wave of mobilization is a challenge. I would argue it can go either way. As I say, there is going to be a breaking point. It's unfortunate that we, from external kind of perspective, very limited data, cannot tell when.
You mentioned this leaked conversation between oligarchs. I have to use this opportunity to ask you about a far less pleasant leak, which is this week's leak of highly sensitive, highly classified U.S. intel regarding different security analysis of the war. It seems to be hanging like a dark cloud. Some even question whether this will damage trust and information sharing between Ukraine and partners in the West. What is your view regarding this issue?
Well, the good thing is it is not highly sensitive part. It's sensitive, it's classified, but for those that are dwelling onto those documents, it's not the top-notch thing that would be really damaging, first. Second, it's damaging for everyone. I would argue it is as much damaging in a ways for Russia
as also.
How do you think, how do they like the level of penetration by the U.S. intelligence services into their kind of internal processes? How would they like the assessments on the number of bots? And not only what is West have kept behind the closed doors, also what Russia is keeping behind the closed doors is now out in the open. So I think also now the Washington Post has been posting, like, I think we're looking at Edward Snowden's type of situation, in my view. Whether the person has been manipulated in doing so or not remains to be seen. But I think I feel it is very similar. Also, the way it's been kind of leaked, Discord first and foremost, and then like in waves. And some of that has, I would argue, some damage control has happened. But yes, that is unpleasant. It has done some damage, obviously. And in a way, ironically, the biggest kind of burden sharer, US, is the most damaged in that. But I think the task at hand will enable to smoothen out some of the situations that have been created. And of course, one also has to recognize, on top of the original leak, there have been the multiple cases where that has been attempted to exploit, was adding on information into the original leak and
trying, manipulating.
Yes. So that is another layer that has happened. But yes, it's unfortunate. Is it like a game changer? No, it is not a game changer. But clearly, yes, unfortunately, US has this history of people just not being, what we would call, clear and understanding what they're doing. what is the reason they do what they do, and therefore mishandling what is highly sensitive and also damages the not only US but also other nations' security situations.
You know, I was recently at a pub with an academic, and he offered
the best academic discussion, huh?
Absolutely. And he offered me this analogy that I would like to hear your view on, whether you think it's credible.
Where is the beer?
Next season of the podcast is, yeah. So the analogy goes in the following way. In the years leading up to World War II, no kind of ceasefire or frozen peace or territorial concession was enough to stop Hitler. And during the war, Hitler's regime was never toppled by a domestic revolution. The German people never rose up against Hitler to take him down. He had to be defeated in the battlefield by allies, the Nazi regime. By the virtue of this analogy, does the same hold true with regard to Putin's regime? We surely cannot give him a frozen peace or some sort of Minsk III. We cannot count on regime change at home to solve the threat posed by the Putin regime. Does this mean that the Putin regime has to be defeated in the battlefield by Ukraine?
You know, the beauty of history is there are many cases you can refer to for whatever current situation you are in. You can refer to Hitler's Second World War, Hitler, as well as you can refer to the First World War. Very different cases. Which one holds true in this particular situation, I think it is hard to tell, and the parallels will be drawn once this conflict is over, everybody knows how it ended, and then people will discover, oh, this is the reason it looked or became like this. I think in our case, what is important also when we talk about Hitler and analogy, there were multiple attempts on his life by the military leadership during that time, not successful, somehow even been pictured in Hollywood movies. But I think that is an element that we also have to recognize. Yes, it was not successful, but there were these processes and attempts. So I agree to the point that to topple Putin, one needs to have Russia defeated. Yes. Yet, does it mean the defeat like the one we saw in Second World War? Very likely not. So I would be on looking just one historic parallel and say, well, that is the reason this time again it will be the same. I would be extremely cautious. Yet there's another troubling sign in my view, which is not going to disappear whatever the outcome, is a radicalization of Russian society. And that is a major trend, the acceptance of violence. Acceptance of violence as solving whatever problem there is. And kind of normalization of that. The video on beheading, like, you know, getting however many likes on Russian Telegram. It's a symptom of the processes in a society. And I have to admit, it, you know, we might be ending up living into the... It was a neighbor that looks like Taliban-led Afghanistan. The highly radical portions of society that normalize violence.
But, so this would mean that, in terms of this radicalization, that this has seeped through wide segments of Russian society, far beyond the regime. Then the way to address this would be some sort of multi-generational process of nation building or of really kind of historical sort of cleansing?
This is a hard one. First and foremost, because the kind of good reliable data, as I've already said, is unavailable on Russia. And in a way, one would argue that any social polling data in the kind of autocracy turning to totalitarian system is very hard to get. So what we can judge is the behaviors and the way people react to the behaviors. And that is where my statement on radicalization is, this radical acceptance, and also the way we see, for instance, the reaction of those families of people that have been killed in the war is pointing in that direction. But solid data is not enough. So hard to tell how big is the dynamic that we can see. Second, on how to deal with that. In a way, one would argue, okay, we have the terrorism anti-radicalization guidelines. They're very, very labor-intensive. It takes time. I would argue in many cases that is the kind of parallel we have to look at. Although, of course, in a country that might not recognize the need for doing any of that. So the good recipe at this point in time is hard to find. We have to understand and see how the war ends, what kind of a dynamic sets in Russia. And I think then we can start realistically talk about how to help Russian society to de-radicalize as much it might actually be possible at all after that. So multiple scenarios, I think, are viable.
So we have the NATO summit coming up in Vilnius in Lithuania. And, you know, there is all sorts of gossip about anticipation, about what kind of dialogue there will be with Ukraine. Maybe some new promises will be made. Maybe we will revive the pledge made at the Bucharest summit, the fateful summit back in 2008. In your view, what is the ideal way to advance cooperation with Ukraine, militarily, politically, and beyond?
Well, the ideal way is Ukraine wins. It sets in process change within Russia, and Ukraine joins NATO. That would be my ideal solution to the problem. Of course, there's a whole separate discussion on how Ukraine will be using their win in this war to transform their own society in something that is kind of based on Western values, is kind of much better at fighting corruption and these kind of nepotism systems that were there before the war. And that is very much kind of part of the equation. But to me, this is simple. Win the war, set the change in Russia, and join NATO. I think from a military perspective, they're certainly capable.
You know, one of the beauties of friendship or alliance is that friends can disagree with each other, but still maintain respect, mutual respect, and work together in other spheres. Over the last few weeks, we have heard some public contrasting statements about the future of the transatlantic relationship and the way it should be. For instance, contrasting statements between French president and prime minister of Poland. How do you see this tension? Should Europe prioritize a course towards the so-called strategic autonomy and lessen dependency on the United States? Or should Europe actually deepen its strategic partnership and kind of military integration with the US?
Well, President Macron has a habit at poking at the problem and therefore generating a discussion that eventually, I think, was a story about brain dead NATO. Actually, kind of, of course, the timing is not good. We're helping Ukraine, and kind of unified front of the West is very, very much important. I think that debate would have had to take place inevitably. My opinion is that we are far stronger as a joint West than two separate entities. Yes, I agree on the fact that to be a strong partner to the United States, EU has to have much more capability, militarily, economically, into the new technologies. And unfortunately, by the words, you cannot accomplish that. You have to show the capability. And I would say that instead of like having a lot of time and effort and political capital spent on the discussion, I would actually be much more concentrating on the raising the defense capability, preparing for the future wars, new technology capability of Europe. Yes, I even understand the certain autonomy in the senses of cybersecurity and number of other aspects that is. But I think one thing that we've seen, Europe and US are the core element of the Western unity. and to stand the chance to weather any storm that might come. And in my view, we're entering a competition time between two systems, democracy versus autocracy, globally. I think we have a far better chance if we're coordinated and united, of course, with this, like, yeah, we're democracies. Full unison agreement is not possible. Yet, kind of key principles. I think that is where we're strongest. Once we start quarreling, we get our different kind of major priorities different, we're weakened.
But in recent years, relations between the US and China have grown more confrontational. More and more tensions seem to be bubbling up. Do you see Europe as needing to take a more proactive role in supporting our strategic partner in the US? Or are you empathetic with, for example, President Macron's recent comments about Europe not needing to get dragged into crises such as Taiwan that are not of direct interest to it?
That was an interesting point. As I've said, timing very unhelpful. We hope it will generate a debate that, you know, then we can say in Europe whether there's actually a common point of view on that. Certainly not now. On this particular case, I think many, many countries in this region would strongly disagree. As I say, of course, we all would prefer the situation with China not to grow into the extreme of conflict, to keep it in this area of competition of systems. And I think everybody would benefit. But also, it's like for tango or conflict, it's always the two parties. And somehow we democracies always look at the democracies like, oh, we've done something wrong and etc. Well, China has also changed their trajectory. Under current president, certainly they've kind of grown much more assertive on the things that would create a potential pathway to a significant conflict. I don't think it is in Chinese interest, so I would prefer this all play out in a kind of competition system rather than advance to anything. But as I've said, in any of these cases, divided we fall, united we stand. And I think that's still relevant today.
And where does NATO fit into this puzzle, let's say? Because, of course, there is this narrative that NATO was not a global policeman.
Well, one of the reasons why NATO has been relevant throughout the decades is the ability of NATO to adjust. Yes, it was for once not kind of made for the global scene. Yet at some point, somebody said that NATO became a global policeman in support of the United States' role in many of those operations. Some resent that. Yet what I've seen as a recent trend, NATO in a way becoming one of these kind of pulling, attracting elements, the other democracies that might not share the same geography, but increasingly being more interested to kind of join up with NATO in some of these instances. Look at Australia, look at Japan, South Korea, and a number of others. So I think the adaptability, but with a common sense, in a way that, okay, let's not say, okay, we're now global, but in some areas, for instance, information, strategic communication information, by definition, not having boundaries, geographical limits, I think that would make sense that we do much more coordination between kind of democratically minded countries that seek security for their information space.
Thank you for that. In a concluding note, I would like to ask you just a couple kind of short questions, because we spoke a year ago, we meet today, hopefully we will speak again in a year to see how the world has changed. So okay. Let me ask you just some brief questions. Will in a year there be more NATO members than now?
Yes.
How many more?
Hard to tell.
Will in a year we be closer to world war than today?
No.
One other question I have to ask, just because I'm worried about my job security. Will next year's podcast be hosted by ChatGPT. How do you see this developing?
I think for now you're secure. Yet you might have to spend far less time in preparing for these podcasts. I think that is where we're at with this AI explosion that we're seeing is the productivity for people in the strategic communication is just exploding. If you know how to use it, if you have the skills and tools to do so, it works both ways. It works for us practicing strategic communications, but also works the same way for those working on disinformation, creating disinformation. So it will be fast moving area, very fast developing. And if there's one thing I would plead to Stratcom practitioners is get ahead. There's multiple opportunities on and the risks on that, and we have to grasp the opportunities. And the fact that in some cases the current technology doesn't feel like, okay, they're not that good, hallucinations and etc., that technology is going to change and grow quickly. So far, our jobs are secure as long as we know how to use this technology. Although over the horizon, it is disputable. It is disputable. Probably some parts of the kind of more mundane work will be taken over by this AI systems. But that would hopefully enable people to spend more time on what they're best at, creativity and, you know, creating new thoughts and projects. So we'll see.
But do you believe that NATO is positioned well to succeed in this kind of new space race like we had during the Cold War?
Well, we have to improve. Allies like US obviously is at the forefront of it. Many others have missed quite a bit on that. As an organization, as any large organization, it takes time to adjust. But I think, as I've said, in comparative terms, NATO has demonstrated the ability to adjust. But of course, it requires somebody to nudge, somebody to give incentives. And I think that what we have to understand, there will be a competition. Who's the better user? Who has the better technology? And that should be a motivation for us to really kind of grasp on it and grow better with it.
Well, on that motivational note, Jan, thank you so much for joining us and see you again in a year.
See you.
Thanks.